Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for the best book turned into a Netflix show.
Or movie.
Or movie?
Or movie.
Or movie.
Actually, in this case, they would both be movies.
Shit. Let's just stick with it. To help me are my two friends, Ian and Joe, two high school English teachers.
My name's Joe Holshue, and Nick, if you are looking for a book, I'm a high school English teacher, turned into a Netflix movie, I would recommend J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, written in 2016 and adapted to Netflix, starring Meryl Streep and probably some other people just recently, like a week ago.
Let's hope so.
My name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, and today, Nick, if you're looking for a book that's been given the Netflix treatment, I recommend you read Rebecca by Dame Daphne du Maurier, because last night I dreamed I went to Manderley again.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
That's a cool name. Dame Daphne du Maurier.
I only want to talk about the name.
Well, Dame's a title.
Or is that her name?
Well, Dame's a title, but Daphne is not a title.
No, that's...
Neither is du Maurier, as far as I'm aware.
What is a dame?
Is it like a duke?
This is going to be part of my fun facts about the author, but a dame is the female equivalent of a knight. So probably the best known dame right now.
Can I guess? Can I guess?
Oh, yeah. Hey, let's do a game. A dame game.
A dame
name game. Name the dame. The game is called Name the Dame. Name the Dame game. Who are some dames?
Judi Dench.
Just going to say Judi Dench. Everybody knows Judi Dench. That's not.
I know it from Top Gear.
Name another one.
Dame. Dame,
well, that's been the rest of this show. Thank you, everybody, for listening in.
I got some more for you. Do you guys want to know some more dames?
I guess.
Dame? Yeah, let's hear some more.
Maggie Smith.
Who?
Oh, Professor McGonagall.
McGonagall, yep. Elizabeth Taylor.
Really?
I didn't know yes. She was British.
Is she alive?
I don't know.
Wait, do you have to be British to be a dame? Or can you get like...
I think you do. Yeah. Julie Andrews. Helen Mirren.
Oh, I would have got Helen Mirren.
Yeah. Somebody named Diana Rigg, who has been in a lot of stuff, but you probably wouldn't know her unless you saw her face, and you'd be like, oh, yeah. Angela Lansbury.
Murder, She Wrote.
You know, as you're saying all these, I'm wondering why we only knew Judi Dench. And I'm just thinking that maybe it has something to do with how, like, it's phonetically all sounds and with their name. Because it doesn't really flow with Helen Mirren, but it sounds wonderful with the double D, Judi Dench.
And Ian, I would like to correct you. I would like to point out that we all know who Diana Rigg is, because she is, of course, the old lady on Game of Thrones, like the cool old queen on Game of Thrones.
Oh, heck yeah.
And she was a Bond girl, I think. Like, she was a smoking hot blonde girl, and then she was like this awesome character on Game of Thrones.
Bond or blonde?
Bond.
Both.
She was a brunette.
Yes, she was. She was a she was Countess Teresa of De Vincenzo. Which is George Lazenby's first and only Bond. Following Sean. Left. And the poster for On Her Majesty's Secret Service has the words in red, far up, far out, far more. And it has James Bond jumping on some skis. So that is where that's at.
So not a successful installment of the franchise is what you're saying.
Well, apparently it's considered one of the film series' most faithful adaptations of an Ian Fleming novel. We should do Ian Fleming. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, absolutely. Let's do Ian Fleming.
Yeah, right now?
Right now. Ad lib Ian Fleming. Here we go.
Oh, which book did you guys read?
I brought 007 GoldenEye, the video game for N64.
I think if you had to, one of the most surprising names in all of the entertainment industry is the name Albert R. Broccoli. part. He's what? Something. He's a producer of the Bond stuff. And I just, it sounds like a code name itself.
Say it again.
Albert R. Broccoli.
It sounds That's like a beautiful. VeggieTales character is what it sounds like.
Oh, boy.
Well, welcome, Litheads. Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. Every week we come up with a theme that's meaningless, and we pitch two books to beat each other to
Now, people don't really know this, but the book that loses ceases to exist. We struck a deal with some unholy eldritch powers, and they are wiped from existence. So I would encourage you to try and go back and read one of those books that's lost
before the god
doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Good luck, guys. Good luck.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Thank you, Ian.
You're welcome.
Just a couple, same wavelength. Same wavelength. I didn't do my exercises like Joe. We do have, of course, some show rules I do want to go over. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. You guys really need to remember that sometimes. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, everybody, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. I think we should get right into our 30-second plots here.
Love it. Let's do it.
And on an aside, I think there's actually... now, this is like a fourth rule.
Oh, no.
Mm. Yep.
Nick, you can't just give us fourth rule. This is not Taco Bell. You can't, by divine fiat, say there's a fourth meal. You can't say there's a fourth rule out of nowhere, because what if we've broken it for the last 24 or 25 episodes?
This rule is important for all hours of the day.
I'm nervous.
I think you guys should start including the page count and the year your books are written. I'm shocked that I even have to enforce this rule, but just listening back at some episodes, there's really no usable information in your plot points. It's really just Joe seems to read quotes from the back of the book, and Ian, you're a little bit better, but I'm still not getting that hard information that I need.
Right.
To be fair, sometimes I do read just the first paragraph from the Wikipedia page, not quotes from the back of the book.
Fair enough. Don't forget your fourth rule, sponsored by Taco Bell. Joe, whenever you're ready.
Hillbilly Elegy at 264 pages is a goodbye song for a dying region. J.D. Vance, hillbilly turned Yale Law School alumni, writes his memoir about what it's like growing up in Appalachia. It blends anecdotes, voyeurism, and sociology to paint a picture of a region that most of us don't know much about. It's the tale about a self-made man, sort of, and takes some timid pokes at what can be done. All right. Did you like my pause over?
No.
Sort of.
I was waiting for you to read a hyperlink.
You can learn more at wikipedia.com/JD Vance #.
Question mark?
I would like to point out that I did write this. I do write this.
Okay. We all believe you, Joe. Ian, take it away.
When Maximilian de Winter brings his new bride back to Manderley, his ancestral home, he hopes she'll fit right in. But the specter of Rebecca, the previous Mrs. de Winter, hangs over the house and refuses to let the new couple be happy. Creepy servants, a foreboding atmosphere, and tightly wound psychological drama culminate in a staggering climax. As soon as I finished all 416 pages of this, I wanted to read Rebecca, which was published in 1938, right away, again.
Oh.
2016. You're lucky I didn't call time, because that you really almost broke that new rule just right away. You know what?
I'm sorry. I have another Diana Rigg connection.
I think. Do we have to talk about British people anymore?
There's a miniseries, Rebecca, a miniseries adaptation, and it stars Diana Rigg. And it stars Charles Dance, who was also a Game of Thrones boy. He was old Mr. Lannister. Lannister.
I don't think
so. Wait, there's a novel. There's a miniseries called Rebecca, based on obviously Dame Daphne Duck's book. That it's.
Don't laugh at
Fun
that.
Fun fact.
That's the funny.
Name, her I guess her middle name. Her first name is Daphne. Her middle name is Dew, and her last name is Maurier. Okay. The first two letters of her middle name are D-U, which is the same as the first two letters of Duck. So
yes, that's how it. That so, but there's a miniseries starring these Game of Thrones actors, including our friend Reg, Diana Reg.
Dame Diana Reg
and Riggs.
Yes. Gosh, I hate that. I hate that title so much.
What?
Dame. It's like
oh well,
it
well
seems it's condescending.
It feels pejorative.
It seems so. It's like a weird there's gotta be more situations where something that used to be framed as like a nice thing, like, oh, good for you, you have this honor, has since become just dreadfully pejorative.
Yeah, well, like toots. Toots Diana Reg.
What is toots?
Toots. No. Like hey, toots.
When was toots good?
Well, I'm, it's a hypothetical situation, Nick.
My goodness.
It's hypothetically a point. What about sir? You could use any title as a negative. Excuse me, sir.
Yeah, that absolutely doesn't have the same kind of valence as
you don't
Dame.
Mean it like that.
No.
Ian.
Yeah.
Tell me about Rebecca.
Oh my goodness. I'm so excited to talk about this
now,
book.
Now, when was this book released and what is the page count again?
It's released in 1938 and the page count is 416.
Nice. Okay, let me write this down.
Mm-hmm. Yep, write those down.
Okay.
I feel like this is going to be used against me in a court of law.
I do feel like page count's a little bit of an arbitrary metric. Like it depends 100%. A lot on the publishing platform.
Yeah. Okay, so guys, here's the thing. I'm going to tell you a bit more about this book because its plot is pretty important. I'm not going to spoil it, okay? I promise you that. I promise you that. Readers, litheads, sorry, not readers. You don't read this. Litheads, I promise you I'm not going to spoil this bad boy. It's going to be spoiler free. So here we go.
Good luck.
Yep. I'm going to need it. In this book, our central main character is an unnamed young woman. Not Rebecca. Rebecca is not the main character. Rebecca, we'll talk about her in a second.
Okay.
This unnamed young woman falls in love with and then
Let's
marries.
Let's call her Dame.
No, I'm not going
to. No name.
I'm not going to call her Dame. Nameless and Dameless. She falls in love with this guy, Maxim de Winter, and he is rich and he's an heir. He has this family ancestral home. And Maxim is a recent widower. His first wife, Rebecca, died in a sailing accident 10 months before. And he really, really doesn't like to talk about it. So this is like the setup. She falls in love with this guy. They get married pretty quickly. And she loves him. He seems to like her quite a bit and possibly love her. But there's this dead wife. They have this wonderful honeymoon. It's great. Then they go back to his ancestral home, which is called Manderley. It's by the ocean in the south of England. And it's the setting for most of the plot's action. It has this atmosphere. It's very, very beautifully described. And it's almost, I hate it when people say this, but it's almost a character in its own right. It's so much a part of this story. Yeah. It's like Manderley is one of the players in this novel. So they go back to this house and it is staffed by a full staff. Now, our unnamed young woman was not like a noble. She was not born into like any kind of privilege at all. She's been pretty poor and kind of middle class most of her life, all of her life. So this is a very much a fish out of water situation. And various things happen at the house, which I'm not going to get into, but they emphasize three key points, which are kind of like important for the development of the story. First of all, apparently everyone loved Rebecca, the first wife. Everyone thought she was the best, the most beautiful, smart, like authoritative, good at everything. She was the best.
The staff, you mean?
Everyone on staff, everyone in the country round, all the friends and stuff, everyone is always talking about how cool Rebecca was.
Anybody who had an interaction with Rebecca thinks Rebecca was just the bee's knees.
Right.
Okay. So they're like having dinner and they accidentally call her Rebecca once.
Well, there's actually a really sad moment when they go to see Maxim's, the husband's mother, the old lady. She's losing her memory. And she looks at the new Mrs. De Winter, our main character. The story is told from this main character's point of view. She looks at this person and says, "Where's Rebecca? What have you done with Rebecca? You're not Rebecca. I want Rebecca." And it's just like such a harrowing moment that everyone is just like,
"Shut up, you old bag."
Back to the home.
The main character feels like everyone around her loves and respects the memory of Rebecca. And her husband, Maxim, has this really complicated relationship with her memory. So like certain things really, really kind of touch him off and make him very sad or very anxious or very kind of torn up, like serious emotional episodes. And the last thing that you should know that this section kind of tells us is that the new Mrs. De Winter, our main character, is very, very different from Rebecca, and she doesn't fit in. So you got this kind of like they're all together. These are all interlaced. Everyone loved Rebecca. Maxim has a complicated relationship with her memory, and the new Mrs. De Winter is very, very different. Doesn't fit in.
Joe, do you know about this book?
Do you know the story? I do know the story. I know it well, depending on how faithful the adaptation on Netflix is. I know it either really well or not at all, but I have seen it on Netflix.
It's pretty close. Yeah.
And not only have I seen it on Netflix, it was pretty awesome.
Good. I'm glad.
On Netflix, you liked it?
Yeah, on Netflix it was.
Mm. Oh, no. Well, there's been Netflix other remakes.
Oh, I think it's been adapted a ton, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
probably most famously by Hitchcock.
Diana Rigg. So, Ian, is Manderly spooky? You say Manderly, you reluctantly say that Manderly is a character. Is Manderly spooky in the book?
It's spooky as all heck. On a scale of one to spooky. I would say it's spooky. Okay. It's pretty spooky. There's these rhododendrons out front.
Very
the
scary.
Spookiest of all plants.
I don't know. You're getting into gardening.
I don't know if you guys know what rhododendrons look like, but look them up, Google them. Litheads, this is a good time for you to take a pause, hit that pause button on your device, and go Google a picture of rhododendrons. And like the introduction to Manderly is she comes around this corner and she sees this huge mass of blood red rhododendron plants just like looming. And they're so foreboding. They're flowers, right? These things get huge. But yes, they're huge and they're blood red. And it's just like very obvious foreshadowing. Yep.
Cool. I'm looking at a picture here and it's a little bit of forced perspective, but there is a rhododendron bush, I guess, tree. I'm not exactly sure what you would call it. It's the size of a two-story house that it's standing next to. It's massive. Yes.
Wow.
They're like shrubs. They're huge.
I'm looking at this image, Joe. It's incredible.
there are other things too. It's not just that. There are.
It's not just the rhododendrons.
There is the backbone
of all the terrifying things that happen.
Of all the literary analysis that is to come.
Yeah.
There's this servant, Mrs. Danvers, who is the housekeeper. And she's like super, she seems to have everything under control and she's dangerous and she has this strange power over our main character, and she's creepy in her own right. And then there are all these mysteries. They live right by the ocean and the ocean is scary. And the end of this book is just, here I am not spoiling it. The end of this book is absolutely harrowing. It's like Alfred Hitchcock on the page. It was unputdownable in the best possible way. Like it ends in this way where it's clear what happens and it makes sense why it happens, but it's just so tragic and just out of reach and powerful. I wanted to read it again as soon as I finished it. I was like, I can't wait until I experience this again. It's incredible.
Wow.
So there we go. Shall I tell you guys about some book facts?
Yeah.
I want to speculate, but this isn't fun because Joe already knows the answer.
Oh, but I have the worst memory for these things in the world. So I am happy to speculate with you. I saw this weeks ago.
Can I no filter guess some potential outcomes?
Yes.
And you don't have to tell me which one is right. Okay.
Yeah. I like this game.
Okay. But just tell me if I guessed it or close enough.
Okay. So you're going to give me like 30 different possibilities. I'm going to say one of those 30 was good.
At least 65 options. And you're going to say yes or no. Okay.
Wait. So wait. If you just guess it, he's going to say yes. Like if you're just like, hey, this is what happens. Ian says yes.
I don't think I have to explain this. All right. So in a way to not give away the spoilers,
you're going to say like five things.
65.
Oh, I will say yes. One of those five is correct.
All right. Okay. So she's actually the reincarnate of Rebecca. And so she's come back and she's like the ghost. All right. So that's maybe one thing. She never really lives up to the potential of Rebecca. And although we don't know anything about Rebecca, this woman kills herself in some sort of tragedy at the end. That could be a thing. She killed Rebecca.
Oh, that's a good one. That's like Talented Mr. Ripley ending.
Yeah, she killed Rebecca, and she's living this pimp ass life because obviously a lot to gain from being this dame.
Yeah, Madame De Winter.
Yeah, Madame De Winter. Great name. Great name. Let's see what else. Rebecca's not dead. She's still in the house somewhere. Let's see. That's one.
Yeah.
The butler did it. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up that the butler had something to fucking do with this. So I could see some sort of Too Many Butlers spinoff here. Too Many Butlers, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Starring Rebecca.
Too Many Dame Butlers.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the title of that one.
Oh.
Yeah.
Gosh Dame It.
Ooh. It's good. Good.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, we'll work on it, but it's good.
Okay. It's good. Yeah, that's a good starting place. Nick, do you have any more?
I feel like I need one more.
You do need one more.
Yep. Okay.
To qualify. Yep. To qualify for the next round.
Yeah. Okay. One more. Did I say Rebecca didn't die? Yeah, she's still in the house.
You said
somewhere.
She's still in the house.
I'm going to say he killed her. He killed Rebecca and he kills and everybody. Oh, here's got it. He killed Rebecca. All of the house staff know it. And he kills his wife every 10 months or every year. This is like the seventh wife he's ever had. And he
like
just kills
him. Like a Bluebeard situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Like just good, like yeah. a weirdo creep in his big rich house with his staff that knows all the details.
He's a rich guy, but he gets away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Elon Musk.
I will say, Nick, none of those is exactly right, but there are elements. You kind of, if we were to patchwork, if we were going to Frankenstein,
yeah.
all of those plot points together, you would get pretty close to
really?
What actually happens in the story. Yeah. So
yeah, brilliant. Hit some good stuff.
I do like this technique for avoiding spoilers. Maybe we can
just
stick with
Nick
this.
Guesses for four just minutes.
Nick guessing for about 20 minutes.
That's what it's like to teach freshmen.
Oh boy.
That's allow us to guess for 4 minutes.
And then a very satisfying ending.
Right. Sort of okay job.
Sort of okay. Yeah. Let's move on.
Ian, do you know a thing that I love about this book or I loved about this show when it was on? I love that it's called Rebecca and yes. that like that's the name that you know. But the main character, the protagonist, who is the first person narrator of this story, never gets a name.
Yep. Yeah, it's stupendous. It's stupendous because like the films and the book, obviously the book can't do this, but we never get a first person narration from Rebecca's standpoint. Like perspective, we never see in the films, we never see Rebecca. She is like this presence. She's this memory that looms, but she is never like on stage, on the page,
no
on,
monologues.
On screen, no mm-hmm. monologues, no, which I think is like this book in a lot of ways is really, really restrained, which is weird to say, because it kind of has this reputation. When it came out, people thought it was like kind of trashy and flimsy. One reviewer said it'll be here today and gone tomorrow, but,
Do we know his name?
No, I don't. Sorry.
The irony. Fuck.
His name is actually Rebecca. Dame uh-huh. Rebecca. Yep. No, it's really fascinating how this book kind of dials it back and doesn't show you everything, doesn't tell you everything. And the final, like the final image, which is this image of cataclysm and catastrophe, it doesn't say this is what happened and this is who did it and this is how it happened. It just suggests it, just hints at it. And you know what's happening, but you don't see it firsthand. Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
Now, Ian, have you watched any of the movies or the TV shows?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of adaptations. There is the miniseries, as I mentioned, starring our good friend of the show, I think at this point, Dame Diana Rigg.
Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes.
And Charles Dance. Yeah. Orson Welles did a radio play of this.
Really?
There is a musical in German, which was made recently, which apparently was pretty good. Did you guys know? Sorry, it's time for a Hobbit fact. Did you guys know that there was a stage musical based on the Lord of the Rings.
It sounds terrible. Did you say it was a stage musical based on Lord of the Rings?
A musical. Like one of these huge high-tech whiz-bang spectacles like the Spider-Man musical or The Lion King. And it was a massive commercial failure, apparently. So, 2006.
Yeah, apparently.
Did it see the day of light?
Oh, yeah.
The light of
it
day?
It played in Toronto, and then it moved to London. And apparently, in Toronto, they called it Bored of the Rings because it was so boring.
Oh, no.
And in London, they called it Flawed of the Rings because it was... So there we go. There's your Hobbit fact. Yes, Nick, I have seen very recent, released earlier this year, stars Lily James as Mrs. De Winter and Armie Hammer as Maxim.
Armie Hammer?
What?
Yeah.
If you're going to choose a stage name, you choose Armie Hammer?
Do you guys not know this? This dude, he played both of the Winklevoss twins in the Facebook movie.
I just want to pause for a second and just let our listeners know that I am so sorry. We normally don't say this many names in a single episode. This is not some sort of podcast in which we name drop or like, you know, deep dives into actors or writers or you know, people writing for magazines. And this is highly irregular. So,
highly irregular. Highly and yet, irregular. Here we are. Here we are.
Did you guys know Barbara Bel Geddes and Peter Coxon starred in the original broadcast television theater with Patricia Breslin and Scott Forbes?
Well, one second. I would like to backtrack on what I said about Armie Hammer. I assumed that he had to like Screen Actors Guild pick a stage name, and he thought it would be like kind of funny to name himself Armie Hammer. Like he'd be like, okay, fine, I'll go.
He was looking around at his soaps and said, Armie Hammer.
He was born in 1986. His last name is actually Hammer, which is a pretty cool last name.
Yeah, that's a great last
but
name.
But his first name is Armand, which is like, what the fuck is wrong with his parents? Like, that's insane. You name your son Armand? Like, Armand Hammer was an international brand in 1986.
Wow.
International
brand. Yeah, you're right.
Brand.
That's pretty cruel.
That's
how is
really
it spelled?
Mean.
You know how it's spelled.
It is literally spelled Arm. And
oh
Hammer.
My goodness.
That is his name.
No. Like, Mr. and Mrs. Hammer, if you're listening, you should be ashamed of yourselves.
Well, hold on. It's not his fault.
No. His parents. His parents need to be ashamed.
Well, hold on now. Is this guy... Maybe he is Armand Hammer.
Oh, my God. Wait one second. He's the great-grandson of oil tycoon Arm and Hammer. Oh, my God. I'm going to follow that link.
This is fucking crazy. Is this guy like the Arm and Hammer heir?
I think Arm and Hammer is named after a guy named Armand Hammer. And I think it's the great-grandfather of
Holy
Lord DeWinter.
Uh-oh. That's fucking crazy.
The old Arm and Hammer was well-known for his close ties to the Soviet Union.
Oh, boy.
Oh, it says he was named after the arm and hammer graphic symbol of the Socialist Labor Party of America, in which his father had a leadership role. This is the old one.
This is nuts.
Ah, and he was also in business with Microsoft.
So are you telling me that Arm and Hammer as a brand has like communist ties, Soviet ties?
Yeah.
Hey, lidheads. This is real-time reporting. You heard this it here first.
Joe smells another red scare and gets excited.
Once again, you don't know that has stumbled into some sort of
a
Nazi
communist
pact.
Plot. This is like the fourth episode that's happened.
This podcast is like 80% literature, 20% fascist plots.
As our most good podcast. Can I tell you guys a couple more things about maybe the Hitchcock film?
I really just want to talk about Arm and Hammer.
Okay. The Netflix movie is fine. It's good. I think it's pretty good in some ways.
Litheads, I thought it was quite good. Litheads. Litheads, right. I have not read the book. Quite good.
I read the book first and then I watched the movie, so who knows.
Oh, so the book is better?
I think so, guys. I think the book is better. Yeah. I think I'm going to draw this line in the sand. The book is better.
Yeah.
In this case, at least. Okay. So the Hitchcock film is interesting. It was Alfred Hitchcock's only best picture. He never won another best picture.
Really?
Wow.
Yes. I was surprised by that.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it was an international sensation, and the story in Rebecca in his movie is so close to the story of the book. I think maybe he won it because people were just like, wow, this is a really good story. We like the story a lot in these characters. And maybe it was less like him putting his unique stamp on it and maybe more it stars Laurence Olivier as Maxim de Winter and Joan Fontaine as the new. So there's more names, but Laurence Olivier is like a huge name in acting. There are awards named after Laurence Olivier, so he's a big deal.
Mr. Tibbs.
What are the names of the awards?
The names of the awards named after Laurence Olivier?
The Olivier Awards?
Ah, okay.
this is a really interesting, this film is really interesting because there is a big kind of climactic reveal in the book about how Rebecca dies. And what the film does is it kind of changes that plot point and it makes a certain character kind of have a different relationship with Rebecca. And this is something which is kind of a huge deal that the film changes this. And apparently, I did some research on this because I was shocked by it. Apparently, the reason that the film had to change this was because the Hays Code. Do you guys know about the Hays Code?
Never heard of it.
Nope.
This is a set of moral rules that governed how movie plots could be. Like, they said you can't have this kind of thing in a movie. Like, we can't show this. Sure. We can't show that in
a
movie.
Oh, wait. I did hear about this. This is the whole separate beds thing, isn't it?
I think separate beds, yes.
So they had to show separate beds in, like, you know, the 60s right. And before then. So, yeah, desexualizing, blah, blah, blah.
They had to, because of something that the Hays Code required, they had to change the plot, because the original way the book frames this plot point, it would not fit with the Hays Code. The Hays Code would require a different plot point. And I'm really struggling not to spoil it here, but I'm not going to, because I'm an ethical person. So
yeah, there I guess go. We can just move past it.
Guys, I'm almost out of time. Can I tell you why you should read this book, please? Really, please. Really, really fast.
Yeah, I guess so.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, here is one thing. This plot is like a jump scare. So it builds and builds and builds and builds, and then bang, everything happens. And all it happens, just it happens all at once and it blows you away. It uses foreshadowing, which is a literary technique. It keeps kind of this slow burn going. And then when you get to the climax, it's just dramatic. It's masterful. And it's not like a romance. It kind of keeps you on edge. Just when we think we have a read on who these people are and how they'll react, Demarié introduces this new batch of just wonderful, unexpected nonsense. I don't know if this book is great art. I'm not sure if it's like high literary art, but I will say it is an incredibly enjoyable story. It's the kind of thing that you want to tell people about, the kind of story you want to share with people, without spoilers, of course. Mm-hmm. I think best books for me are the books that I start, like as soon as I finish reading it, I think, how can I teach this? How can I put this in the classroom and like introduce students to the majesty and the brilliance that is this book? And I think here's the last reason why you should read this book.
Okay. Because there's
we've heard about the turn of the screw in previous weeks. Mm-hmm. That marvelous cop out by Henry James, where it's not clear, is it a ghost story or is it not? I think a lot of ghost stories set out to do one of two things. So either they try to trick people into being surprised that ghosts exist, or they try to trick people into being surprised when ghosts don't exist.
Mm.
But this one says, like, up front, there are not real ghosts. Ghosts don't exist in this world. It's not supernatural. But this character, Rebecca, haunts these people nevertheless.
Jack London.
You don't even know where he's from, do you?
Well, is he not from London?
He's not.
That's no. False advertising.
Well, I don't know that someone's name is advertising. Like, I don't think we listen, like we meet our good friend Joe over there and we imagine that he has a hole in his shoe.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
That's a good point.
Can I give you some Jack London quotes?
Please.
I guess.
I wish you would.
Darn the wheel of the world. Why must it continually turn over? Where is the reverse gear?
It's a good one.
Yeah. Well,
there's more.
Joe, I feel like Jack London's kind of like right up your alley.
Yeah.
I think we should talk about Jack London.
The proper function of man is to live, not to exist. I shall not waste my days in trying to prolong them. I shall use my time.
Nick, did you like Ernest Hemingway?
Yes.
Okay, because Jack London's kind of like Ernest Hemingway, maybe without some of the tragedy in his life, and also without headbutting his way out of a burning airplane.
Oh, but those are the best parts of Ernest Hemingway.
That's, I would say the headbutting is great.
So Jack London is kind of like Hemingway without all the good parts.
Yeah. He's like boring Ernest Hemingway.
Sweet. Do you guys have any short stories by him?
Yes.
Sweet. Do you want to bring those next week?
Sure. Yes. I would rather be a superb meteor, every atom of me a magnificent glow, than a sleepy and permanent planet. And Nick, you can't wait for inspiration. You have to go after it with a club. Nick, next week, I would like to bring the short story The Mexican by Jack London.
Cool. I haven't read that one. I would like to bring Jack London's classic short story To Build a Fire because it's getting cold outside.
I'm looking forward to getting into Jack London's shorts.
Ian, one of my jobs at school is I run this thing called the Writing Center, which is exactly what it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And students come and a really common thing that we do is we help students with college essays. And it's so one of the most common problems I get is students will say like, look, I went through all your advice. I wrote the essay. It needs to be 650 words maximum. And I have like 900 words. I just need to cut out words right now. Right. I need to cut out words. And I'm always blown away. All I do with them is I go through and we don't modify anything. All I do is hit the delete key. All I do is like highlight things in backspace, highlight things in backspace. It is shocking. You can take out 30% of a student's essay and it is better for it. Like it's that much better when you take out 30%.
I mean, it's the Hemingway. It's the iceberg thing. Mm-hmm. I think we're so invested in over explaining everything. We're not willing to give it a try to just see what happens.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, and you get so married to like the stuff that you do, especially students. Oh, yeah. Like they write something and they're like, well, I have to use it because I did it. Like it took me a while to come up with that. So I have to use it. And it's like, well, no, you could just like keep these two words and it's good.
I know we're not a writing podcast, but Lit Heads, if any of you are writers, let me pass on a piece of advice that I got, which directly backs up what Joe is saying. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to write your way into your ideas.
Oh.
And if you have to delete those words that you've written to get there, it's not the end of the world.
Nope.
You're not wasting them. They're not wasted because you've gotten to the ideas and it's good to get there. So,
well, I'm always envious of like when you read about these old writers who had read on typewriters, I'm always envious because even if you like write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite on a typewriter, at the end of the day, you have this pile of discarded paper. And I always think like, at least you have something at the end of the day, where I think a student now or anybody can sit in front of a screen and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And at the end of the day, like you have less than you started with, but it's better.
All right, Joe, I'm ready to hear about the deep, deep South.
The deep, deep South. Nick, I read this week Hillbilly Elegy, the 2016 memoir from a guy named J.D. Vance. It is, of course, 276 pages long.
Of course, as we remember.
Of course.
Published. Published when?
Published in 2016. Won a couple of awards in 2016. Then actually got more famous as 2016 went on for reasons we'll talk about in a second. And then in 2017, won a couple more awards. I don't have much to say about J.D. Vance himself. Like the book follows him, this main character, J.D., through his childhood, through high school.
J.D. Vance is the author?
Yeah.
And he's also the main character.
Yeah. It's a memoir.
Hey. Yeah. So oh, Nick, it's you a real memoir. These things called memoirs.
It's a real memoir.
Okay. I thought.
Nick, I'm curious. Have you read fake memoirs?
I just thought it was all right. I don't know what I thought it was. I didn't think it was a real memoir. I thought it was just like a you know, just an expression, like a nod towards a memoir.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, like an
when
odyssey,
you go to like a fusion, you know, restaurant. It's like, this is my interpretation of a memoir.
Yeah, I thought it was like a little, you know, a wink and a nod.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a wink and a nod. It's like a kick in the elbow. It's
okay.
Memoirs, as we've talked about many times before on this on this show, are a snippet of a person's life. Like they are the story of a certain aspect of a person's life. So Andre Agassi writes the memoir Open about his life as a professional tennis player. Not his whole life, not an autobiography, but just the snippet. Mm-hmm. J.D. Vance's memoir is about ostensibly growing up in Appalachia, but it's also about like growing up and then getting out of Appalachia. Appalachia, of course, is the mountainous region, a lot of times considered like eastern Tennessee, parts of Ohio, certainly parts of Kentucky, in which we think of hillbillies. Like when we think of our stereotypical hillbillies, we are talking about Appalachia, where they come from.
How offensive is that term?
Good question.
Can we Google hillbilly. That?
Are you talking about Appalachian?
Yeah. Hillbilly people specifically.
I'm looking it up right now, guys. Just can't give me a second.
Is this like Dame, where like
it's like a title that you earn?
Is it a title? Like
okay, so it's
super offensive.
First attested from 1892. It's not necessarily
It depends on the tone in your voice to see if it's offensive or not.
Well, I think there's a difference between something being offensive and something being derogatory. So like you can say somebody, like you can call someone a generalizing
butthead.
Name, and it might not be like offensive the way the N-word is, but it might be sure. derogatory. And like if you called people from Wisconsin a bunch of
cheese fuckers.
Bunch of cheese fuckers.
Okay, just trying to help you out here. It's your story.
Thank you. I appreciate it, I guess. I think that might be derogatory, but not necessarily offensive. There are other terms which are like offensive in their nature that aren't derogatory.
Okay, I'm not sure that added any clarity, but okay, so hillbilly's definitely offensive. If you call somebody hillbilly, it's definitely offensive. Let's move on.
Well, okay. I would like to point out that the title of this book is Hillbilly Elegy. So the novel follows J.D. Vance, and J.D. Vance is born in eastern Ohio. He's born into like this, what he calls like this hillbilly royalty family, and he grows up in poverty, like in kind of like white, working class Appalachian poverty.
But that's still royalty?
Well, for hillbillies.
That's a confusing sentence.
The more poor you are,
in J.D. Vance's terms, like the more like backwards you are, the more proud you are of your mountain heritage, the more hillbilly you are.
Okay.
It follows him through his childhood, through high school, through his eventual service in the Marines, his enrollment at Ohio State, and then finally Yale Law School, and just like kind of touches on his very early career. So the compelling thing about this book is J.D. Vance, this guy born in eastern Ohio, gets out of poverty. He gets out of Appalachia, and he really makes a name for himself.
Gotcha.
Huh.
So is this book boring, Joe?
No. In fact, it does sound boring. And at times... Yep.
I think that's what we're all thinking.
It's concerning. It's a concerning concession you just made there.
One of the cool things about this book is... Well, I guess let me get into my three things and the things that I really like about this book.
I didn't answer the question.
One of the fun things about this book.
Let me answer your question with three unrelated points. All right, cool. I'm ready, Joe. Give me your 3 points.
Okay. One of the fun things about this book that is absolutely not boring is the hillbilly isms. Right. Like the glimpses into mountain lifestyle, the glimpses into Appalachian life that were like not devastating, which some of them are, but instead like kind of fun and kind of charming. Let me give you an example.
Please do.
Please.
Vance is talking about his grandma, and his grandma, he calls her Mama the entire time. Mama is, of course, married to Papa. She's one of the best characters in this book, and they tell a story about when she was younger and her husband was a drunk. One of the themes that comes up over and over again is just like various substance abuses.
Drinking.
Yeah. Well, just substance abuse of many kinds in Appalachia.
Okay.
Her husband's a drunk and he's kind of a mean drunk. And she finally gets fed up with it. And she tells him, hey, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm going to kill you. Like not I'm going to divorce you, but like I'm going to kill you.
Not ha-ha kill you.
Yeah, he's good for a little while. Like, he comes home, he kind of walks the line, he does a good job, he doesn't drink, and then one night he goes out and he just gets wound right tight. He just gets pissed up, right? And he comes home very drunk and falls asleep, passes out on the couch. Mama
kills him.
She douses him in gasoline.
Wow.
And lights a pack of matches and drops it on his chest on the couch and just lights him on fire. Like, that's
okay.
Okay. So that's obviously insane. Like, obviously nuts. But it's also like kind of fun to read because he's.
I'm sorry. Does he die?
No, he's fine. It says,
He's okay. He was doused in gasoline and lit on fire, yeah. But he's really okay.
They're built tough down more there.
In Vance's words, he says, miraculously, Papa survived the episode with only minor burns. There's another scene later on in which J.D. Vance he's kind of at the end of high school. He's done really well on his ACTs. He's gotten accepted to the Ohio State University, and he's the Ohio State. And he's super excited to go, but he gets really nervous to go. And he decides that the Marines are just what he needs. His mama, who he lives with, has no interest in him joining the Marines. And when the Marine recruiter shows up, Mama answers the door with a shotgun and informs him that if he sets one foot on her porch, she's going to blow it off. And the Marine recruiter talks to her from the front yard the entire time.
I'm concerned that the trend of these little snippets are really condoning violence.
Are we a criminal podcast? This is a true crime podcast.
And I guess I do
now?
Want to pause to just make sure that everybody knows that we don't condone violence on this
podcast. No, we just report the facts. We report the facts.
Now, I asked you if this book was boring.
Yeah.
You have shared two stories that are not boring.
Yes, thank you.
Do you have
a
third?
That's true. I will give you that.
I do have a third. Well, my third story is nice. For all of Mama's... instability? I don't know the word.
Imperfections.
For all of her flaws.
Her little foibles.
Hold on. Yep. Southern charm.
Yes.
For all of Mama's imperfections, one of the things that's so true is she is the most stable force in J.D. Vance's life. His mother is in and out of rehab. She has like substance abuse problems her whole life, even though she's like a registered nurse and like at times has a pretty good job. She has a series of boyfriends and husbands. J.D. Vance's paternal father gives him up for adoption so he will stop paying child support on him. And like this, like J.D. Vance has this very, very rocky, rocky childhood, but Mama is there as like the rock in his rocky childhood, like the one thing that he can hold on to.
So this turned into a movie. It's on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, I really don't know anything about it, but as you describe kind of the premise in the little sub stories here, this is like every director's all over this. This is like Oscar bait, isn't it? Like, give me a super flawed family.
Yep.
Give me some sort of accent.
Yep, regionalism.
An underdog story.
Not a super well-known.
And give me Amy Adams looking like dog shit. And you are going to definitely win an Oscar.
As soon as I saw Meryl Streep's makeup for this movie, I thought, oh shit, Ron Howard's going to get an Oscar.
Yeah, this is prime. Good character-driven story, huh?
Yeah, the best part of this book is Mama, period. Right, like far and away, the best part is Mama. The best parts of this book, though, are the characters in this book and just this glimpse into this world. And I think this is always the strength of memoirs and biography and autobiography. It's this glimpse into this world that we aren't exposed to, that we know absolutely nothing about.
I heard the movie wasn't that great.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I also heard that. Oh, no.
Really?
Yes.
Sorry, Ron.
Yeah.
Hang it up, bud. This is, we did Andy Griffith last week.
Yeah, 30% on Rotten Tomatoes, 40% on 30? Metacritic. Yeah, that's pretty bad.
30?
Nick feels betrayed.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, Nick, have you submitted your review yet? Because that'll probably boost her up to like 32, 35.
I haven't seen the movie yet.
Oh, well, you should go watch it and then give it a review and that'll boost it right up there.
Let's hope the book is better, huh?
Yeah. Well, the book's pretty good.
28 on Rotten Tomatoes. Sorry, Amy Adams. I mean, can we just stop dressing Amy Adams up in terrible makeup? Can we just let her be a normal? Let her be yourself.
Can we just admit that Amy Adams is a beautiful redhead? That's all anybody wants Amy Adams to be.
She needs to admit it first. Stop putting on all that makeup.
Yeah, maybe she's hiding behind the makeup.
Yeah, what are you hiding behind, Amy?
Maybe she's hiding behind Glenn Close. Mm. Does she spend a lot of the movie kind of like literally standing in the
physically behind
rear
Glenn
of
Close.
Glenn Close? Because that's like, there's your problem right there.
Wait, is it Meryl Streep or Glenn Close?
Yeah, it's Glenn Close, isn't it?
Oop.
Whoops. All right.
Oops. Maybe they could have got a higher percentage with Meryl Streep.
If they had sprung for Meryl Streep, maybe the film wouldn't be 30% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Maybe like 40, 45%. So there's other things I like about this book. I'm running low on time. I will say just very quickly, one of the things that I think is a lot of fun about this book, like that I dig a lot, is that like it's a book that simultaneously gives you a view into what it's like to grow up in Appalachia and what it's like to go to Yale Law School. And those two things could not be further from each other. But the fun part of reading this memoirs, of course, is like that is J.D. Vance's life, right? And like those juxtapositions is just, it's
the only
cool
reason it works.
It's why it works. That's exactly it. So the last thing I want to talk about here is this book is controversial. Nick, I know you like a controversial book.
That is correct.
Yep. Okay. J.D. Vance isn't really that Appalachian.
Oh no.
Yeah, he's kind of appropriating culture.
Was he born there?
He was born in Ohio, and he was born in Eastern
not a good start.
Ish Ohio. And Meemaw, I will say, Meemaw is Appalachian, like through and through.
Okay.
But
that's good.
All accounts, like J.D. Vance certainly had like a rocky childhood, but he also had like a pretty stable support network in his childhood. Like his mother struggled with addiction, but she was also like relatively middle class. Like she was a registered nurse. She had an okay job. One of the things that J.D. Vance gets criticized of is telling the stories of basically the generation before him or two generations before him as his own. And really kind of like, riding those, I guess maybe riding the coattails of his Appalachian ancestors.
So when I was given such shit over this being a memoir, you know, so it wasn't, it's not. So you're saying it's, how is it?
Oh, no.
Did family members come out and say, yeah, that guy didn't have a rough upbringing or what?
It is a memoir.
Meemaw doesn't even have a shotgun.
Yeah. So it is a memoir. Like it is J.D. Vance telling stories about his life. The main criticisms come from Appalachian scholars. So like people like Appalachians themselves, right?
People who would know.
And then Appalachian scholars. They come from apples. And they come out and say like, hey, look, that's not what it's like here. Like you were painting broad caricatures. Like Meemaw's a lot of fun, but not what people are actually like. He talks a lot about like systemic poverty, and he talks a lot about he gets into studies. He talks about sociology. He talks about like why the working poor remain poor, why the working poor are so staunchly Republican, and why the working poor like he's very critical.
Sure,
he's very critical of the working poor, and I don't want you to take that the wrong way. J.D. Vance sees himself, or at least he presents himself, as somebody who pulled himself out of poverty by support networks. Absolutely. Like people around him. Absolutely. Like he talks about going to Yale and getting like grants to go to Yale that made essentially the finest law education in the world, an education that assures him a lifetime of prosperity, was essentially cost free to him. Right. So like he acknowledges he was the benefactor of support networks, but he also like looks at the other hill people, the other hillbillies, the other people from his community who didn't do what he did. And there's like absolutely judgment in his tone. There's absolutely judgment in his voice where he says, look, anybody can get out of poverty. Look, I did it. Sure, things had to line up for me. Sure.
That's the moral of this book?
Yeah, JD.
Are you just going to work harder?
JD Vance. Work,
pull up your bootstraps?
I guess the biggest criticism I see against Hillbilly Elegy is this holier-than-thou attitude about everything that JD Vance talks about. He kind of comes across and says, I'm such a hard worker. Everyone else is lazy. I'm the one here with the real perspective. Everyone else is an elitist. I've also heard people say that there is an inverse correlation between your actual level of personal experience with the rural Southerners and how insightful you think this book is. So they say, yeah, this book seems really insightful unless you know anything about rural Southerners. At that point, it seems like a little broad brushed.
I think those two go together really poorly. They don't go together. They should not go together. Like having this holier than thou attitude and maybe not actually being legitimately
what you said you were.
Yeah.
Right. Be like it'd be one thing if he were like this dyed in the wool.
Yep.
Really, really like he grew up, he had to deal with it. He had to be lit on fire. He had to light people on fire himself. Mm-hmm. He had to watch people being lit on fire. Like it's one thing if you have been through it and then you say, yeah, like I have been through this. I have the receipts. And now you lazy bums get to work. Mm. But if he doesn't have that personal clout, if he doesn't have that personal experience, it sounds like lecturing. It sounds like preaching.
That's the point. It's not a story to tell. So what's the redemption here, Joe? Why does the story work even?
Well,
or does it not?
I think
when you learn more about it.
About halfway through this book, I took a pause, kind of set it on the back burner. In that intermission, I happened to stumble across a bunch of stuff about J.D. Vance's life. And I
Oh, that's a mistake.
Yeah, and I stumbled across...
You gotta go radio silent.
Yep, that was it. And all of a sudden, I had too much information. And I think it really colored my reading of the second half of this book.
Have you not learned anything from this podcast, Joe? You don't look into the author, okay?
Yeah.
Because let me just tell you some things about some authors.
Okay, uh-huh.
They were drunks. They beat their wife. They left their wife. They had an affair on their wife. They were all Nazis. All of them were Nazis or Nazi sympathizers. You can't look into it, okay?
So
and so you came back to it and you couldn't finish.
I finished.
Did you read this book, Joe?
Yeah, I did. I finished this book. Actually, this morning I finished it. I've really gotten into the habit of really getting under the wire with these.
Under the wire.
This is the biggest redemption that I have for this book.
Okay.
The thesis of Hillbilly Elegy, if I had to put one, is that anyone who isn't able to escape poverty is at fault. While that thesis is incredibly simplistic, incredibly misleading, Vance does put some responsibility on the individual, but to his credit, he talks at some length in the late chapters about information gaps, the importance of support systems, learned helplessness, and people being stuck in a certain culture. So for all the flack that J.D. Vance gets, I don't think the criticism is that deserved. I think that his...
Sure. Maybe a little harsher than it should be.
That's exactly it. I think his actual approach to this is more reasonable.
I think when you write a review, you have to, and when you read critically, you have to some extent, do some boiling down to say, like, what is the, like you just said, what is the main thesis of this book? And so maybe in the process of boiling down, you omit the fact that there are some legitimately defensible positions that he takes, as opposed to he's all just down on poor people. It's your own fault. You should try stop being, don't be pushed, don't be so poor.
Boy, there's just no way you're winning this week, Joe. I feel like you kind of knew that.
Well, can I give you one more fact about...
Why don't you wrap it up? Give us your closing statement here.
Okay. J.D. Vance is the only person I've ever heard of who converted to Catholicism.
And that, do you think that was a point in your favor or against? You really marred this book. And like, I feel like, is the book bad or is just the author that terrible?
Yeah, book's okay.
You really, really cast a pretty poor shadow.
Book's pretty good. Netflix show seems not that good.
Okay. Well, every week we pitch two authors and we see which one is morally superior. So this week, Ian, I think you win. But more importantly, great. Joe, you lose.
J.D. Vance loses.
Well...
Wait, is that why you brought J.D. Vance on the show?
To lose.
To pile on.
No, actually.
Good. Folks, J.D. Vance, Dame Daphne, and all the rest, I will ask you humbly, I will humbly implore you, if you enjoyed today's show, if you've enjoyed previous shows, or if you're a time traveler and you've enjoyed future shows, please do hop on over to iTunes and give us one of them sweet, sweet five-star reviews. Get us.
And most podcasts are just going to ask for a review. Not us. We know we want the five stars.
We don't want anything less.
If you're going to give us anything less, just tune us out right now. Listen to the next episode. It's nice. Thank you. That you would take some time to do it, but we don't need it.
And there's always, if you didn't like this week, there's always next
week.
I especially want to recommend today that you take a look at our website and possibly submit a book. We love getting reader submissions because it introduces us to your favorites. So please, if you have a book that you think should appear on this podcast, go over to our website, youdontknowlitpodcast.com, and submit a book, and we will read it at some point in the future. Our timeline is a little bit flexible there, but we'll read it and we'll talk about how good it is on the podcast.
Lovely. Thank you, Ian. Why don't you give us that final quote?
Okay. So this is the book famously begins with this line: last night I dreamed I went to Manderley again. And so the whole first chapter is our main character recounting her dream. And it's an introduction to this house of Manderley. And this is how the chapter ends. And this is kind of like sets you up for what the whole thing is going to be like, the whole book, in terms of spooky and in terms of foreboding and in terms of like beauty marred. The house was a sepulcher. Our fear and suffering lay buried in the ruins. There would be no resurrection. When I thought of Manderley in my waking hours, I would not be bitter. I should think of it as it might have been, could I have lived there without fear. I should remember the rose garden in summer, and the birds that sang at dawn, tea under the chestnut tree, and the murmur of the sea coming up to us from the lawns below. I would think of the blown lilac and the happy valley. These things were permanent. They could not be dissolved. They were memories that cannot hurt. All this I resolved in my dream while the clouds lay across the face of the moon, for like most sleepers, I knew that I dreamed. In reality, I lay many hundred miles away in an alien land and would wake before many seconds had passed in the bare little hotel bedroom, comforting in its very lack of atmosphere. I would sigh a moment, stretch myself in turn, and opening my eyes, be bewildered at that glittering sun, that hard, clean sky, so different from the soft moonlight of my dream. The day would lie before us both, long, no doubt, and uneventful, but fraught with a certain stillness, a dear tranquility we had not known before. We would not talk of Manderley. I would not tell my dream. For Manderley was ours no longer. Manderley was no more.